Hello and welcome to what is now Season 5 of Pebble in the Pond podcast. My name is Sam Stewart and I am the CEO of the Australian and New Zealand Mental Health Association. Each year, ANZMHA hosts several leading mental health conferences which give us the opportunity to connect with incredible industry leaders, lived experience speakers, researchers, academics and frontline workers as they share fascinating stories and projects which are changing the face of mental health within our community. Listen in as we go one-on-one with these inspiring people and dive deep into their work. It is truly a privilege to bring you their stories. Our podcast episodes may contain content which could be triggering for some people. If you need support, please contact Lifeline on 131114 or visit the Get Help page on anzmh.asn.au. Join us for Pebble in the Pond each Tuesday and let's get into Season 5. Belinda Connell has been a registered social worker for 25 years and has over 10 years' experience in suicide prevention, delivering living work suicide intervention training in Australia and overseas. Belinda also served as a sworn police officer with the New South Wales Police Service and is very proud of her first responder family background. In today's episode, we chat with the stigma around talking about suicide. We also discuss the Living Works program, which can empower people to learn the skills which could help someone stay safe and the improvements which can be made to first responders and frontline worker mental health support systems. Thank you, Belinda.
Welcome to another episode of Pebble in the Pond. My name is Talitha Natt and I'll be hosting this episode alongside my lovely guest, Belinda Connell. We are at the Frontline Mental Health Conference up on the Gold Coast. Belinda Connell has been a registered social worker for 25 years and has over 10 years' experience in suicide prevention, delivering Living Works suicide intervention training in Australia and overseas. Prior to joining Living Works, Belinda worked in government and non-government sectors and has also served and sworn in as a police officer with the New South Wales Police Force. We're going to be diving into her experience on the front line and as well as her work in the mental health and suicide prevention space. Belinda, it's a pleasure to have you here next to me this morning. Welcome.
Thank you, Talitha. Good to be here.
Absolutely. So I think we'd like to dive into your experience. Let's go back in time, shall we? And let's rewind the clock to 25 years ago when you first started working as a social worker. So can you tell me a bit about your time in that sector and how you, I guess, made the decision to work in the social avenue?
Yeah, sure. Well, about 25 years ago, I guess what I wanted to do, I knew that I wanted to be in some sort of helping profession. And at the time, social work was the one that, you know, I had heard about. I'd met social workers and really valued the work that they did. So my initial thought was, that's how I want to spend my career. And I did. I went through uni. I became a registered social worker and got to work in lots of different sectors. And I enjoyed it. But for me, I guess coming from a family of first responders, always in the back of my mind, I was so proud of my father and my brother that I decided at a later point in life that I would also join the New South Wales Police, which is what I did.
I was looking at your bio this morning when I was reading through your background, and the first thought that I had was like, it's evidently clear that you have a clear passion for helping people. You wouldn't naturally be a social worker or go to the police force or work in suicide prevention unless you deeply cared for others around you. Where do you think that deep innate caring or empathy and compassion came from? Was it instilled in you from an early age in childhood?
I think it was, and I think my father had a lot to do with that. I mean, I remember being so proud of him. He was a fire since I was born, so I grew up, you know, I actually lived in a fire station in Sydney when I was young. And I think when I could see him and the work that he did and how much he valued it and how rewarding it was for him, and then later in life my brother, I guess that's where my passion for it came. Mm-hmm. It was during the early years as a social worker when I became interested in the suicide prevention sector.
Right.
And so that sort of I wanted to combine all those sort of passions that I had, and the police force was one way to do that.
So what kind of work did you do as a social worker, just for our listeners to understand what a day in the life of a social worker was 25 years ago?
Absolutely. So I had a variety of different positions. I started off working in a brain injury unit, a community-based organisation, as a social worker helping people who had acquired brain injuries. I've also done some time in the mental health sector, so I was a social worker in mental health, and also in, this is going back so long ago now, social security, it used to be called, but Centrelink is what people would know that as.
Ah, right.
Yeah, so I had a pretty broad experience. I also got the opportunity to work on some great teams. So I remember years ago doing a project around the private boarding house industry and people with mental health problems. So, yeah, I had a good wide range of experience.
Can you look back on that experience and review some key takeaways or insights or learnings that you have to this day?
Sure. I think the things that stand out for me from my early career is the importance of always, I wanted to be good at what I was doing, and I learned the importance of listening, listening to people and what they actually need. And when you do that, I think in any profession, it enhances your skills, it enhances your ability to be able to reach out and help people in the way that they would like to be helped. So people are the experts in their own lives. And we come along with some skills and some knowledge, but the importance of working alongside people is the thing that I think most stands out for me in my early career.
And from a training perspective, you mentioned you went to university to get your degree in social work, was it?
That's right.
Do you feel what you learnt in the course over the duration of a year or two, or however long your university studies were, served you well in the field per se, or do you feel like you literally learn on the job as to how you help people in a case-by-case scenario?
That's an interesting question. I think, I mean, it's very valuable, the learning that you do during your years at university. It gives you a lot of theory and you understand and get some knowledge around that. But I think also that on its own is not enough. That much of your learning will come from being on the job, to having those experiences, to reaching out to people and providing the care and support that you can. One can't be without the other. You need both.
Absolutely. So moving forward from social work, you then went into suicide prevention training.
I did.
So was that a byproduct of your social work, or was it something that you saw within, I guess, the work that you did, that you thought, okay, that needs more attention. There's people suffering here and I want to be able to help those. Can you tell us a bit about, I guess, how you ended up in suicide prevention training?
Sure. And it sort of relates back to that last question, because in some of my formal education, we did learn around the topic of suicide prevention. And I remember writing a paper about that topic. But when I literally got out into the field, the first time that I connected with someone who told me that they had been thinking about suicide, for me it was a moment where I realised, oh my goodness, I don't know a lot about this area. I want to be able to help this person, but felt a little bit like I need to understand this more.
Yeah.
That's when I was able to link in and do some additional training to actually learn the skills, how do we have that conversation. So that's sort of how I transitioned into becoming very passionate and interested in being able to help people in that way.
So that's a pretty big question though, isn't it? I mean, how do you have that conversation with someone you are concerned about in regards to whether they are a risk to themselves? So let's go into the training with Living Works, because that's obviously a clear passion of yours. Can you tell us, in your experience, who should take this training and why?
It's very easy for me to answer. I think this is the type of training that anybody and everybody can do. And because there's different types of training programs that we can offer, for some people it might be just a 1 to 2 hours of training to get a really good understanding and some of those skills to start the conversation. For other people, it will be to do the half-day program and for many people also, the full 2 days where you will learn skills to help someone stay safe from suicide.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that's going into things like safety planning. Safety is always the focus.
Okay. Now, obviously, we can't go through the whole coursework in this podcast episode as much as I'd love to, but can you describe a brief, I guess, step-by-step overview as to what you can do as a bystander, as a community member, if you're worried about your neighbour, your son, your daughter? What are some quick steps that you can do or educate others so that if they are in a position where they are worried about someone's safety, they have something in their knowledge bank to refer to?
Sure. And I guess one of the, when I said, you know, everybody can sort of learn these type of skills, that's because the people who are most likely to pick up when somebody might be struggling are the people around that person. So it could be a neighbour, it could be a friend, it could be a work colleague. And when you pick that up, a lot of people might be wary to start a conversation about the things that they're noticing. So this sort of training gives people the confidence to know that it's okay to start this conversation, that it's okay to talk about suicide and to ask directly about it. Mm-hmm. That for many people isn't something that they've done in the past or something that they've talked about with others. So a lot of it is about getting comfortable with that conversation. Mm-hmm. And the training can help guide you through how we can respond with a real focus on what this person needs in this moment.
Mm-hmm.
And the focus is always on to be safe from suicide. So we can sort of learn how to start, how to pick up when you're worried, and then respond to that by asking,
mm-hmm.
and then being guided through the use of a model of first aid, really, because
sure.
it's first aid.
Yes.
To help them stay safe. So
for example, if I was worried about, I'm just going to use you as an example because you're sitting right in front of me.
Sure.
But if I was concerned about your well-being, would a question such as, Belinda, I'm noticing that you seem to be in distress right now. I'm worried that you may be at risk of taking your own life. I just want to sit with you for a moment to talk through if you're open to that. Are you okay? I mean, how would, I guess there's, when you said like being comfortable, like you've got to be comfortable to be uncomfortable about asking that question because it is like
yeah.
you tend to find that you squirm in your seat a little bit because you don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what I'm talking about asking you that question. So what would you say to yeah. someone?
Well, I'd say if you were concerned about someone or you're noticing they might be a little bit different to how you usually would know them, then it's okay to start that conversation around the things that you're noticing.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly like you did then. You know, I've noticed this. Is everything okay with you right now? And then remember I said listening is so important.
Mm.
Listen to the person.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think it could be about suicide, you don't have to know 100% whether it is or not, then it's very okay to ask directly about it.
Mm.
Something like, I can hear what you're saying and I'm wondering now, have you been thinking about suicide?
Right. And how often would you think that you would get an honest response? I mean, do you feel like when you ask that question with someone who's in clear distress, they're likely not in a clear place within their mind and emotions are running high. Do you feel you get the answer that you know to be true or not to be true? How do you gauge that?
Yeah, great question. And while it can be uncomfortable for us to ask that question, it can sometimes be quite difficult for people to answer that.
Mm.
In my experience, one of the things I know, the more comfortable we are to be able to ask that clearly and directly, maybe the more comfortable that person will feel to be able to give an honest and open answer.
Yeah.
But I also want to acknowledge that it can be difficult for people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay too if it takes a bit of time.
Mm.
One of the things I'd like people to know, it is one of the most helpful things that you can do to ask.
Sure.
Yeah? And if you need to ask just a couple of times, that's okay.
Mm.
But yeah, that's what I would say to that. It's not easy to ask.
Absolutely.
And sometimes it's not easy to
answer, speak either.
But the best chance of them feeling okay to answer that mm-hmm. question is to be able to ask it with some level of confidence.
There's that saying that keeps pumping into my mind now, which is speak even if your voice shakes. And I feel like that's so relevant to so many aspects of mental health. But I'd like to explore a little bit around the stigma associated with suicide in its entirety. like a lot of mental health issues, if you will, there is huge stigma that is still attached to the very touch points. And if that were the case, then I feel that we'd see a lot more people coming forward and putting their hand up for help. Do you feel that the stigma around suicide is preventing people to get the help they need or to have that conversation as a starting point?
Absolutely. I think it can be a barrier to people reaching out and accessing, you know, support and other help that can be really beneficial for them and help keep them safe. So the stigma is one of the barriers, and that's why it's so important for us all, I guess, to get used to being able to talk about suicide. I know when I was young and growing up, it wouldn't have been a topic that people would talk about. Mm. People might feel very fearful. And one of the things that I hear a lot that stops people from talking about it is people who are willing to, you know, reach out and help really have a sense of, I don't want to make it worse, and maybe if I talk about it, it might make it worse.
Yeah.
That's why it's so important to learn a bit about it and to understand that it is a helpful thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can talk about these issues, reduce the stigma. It's a human thing for many people.
Yeah. What do you think it would be, or what do you think we need to understand as people who are not living with severe distress mentally, who are not in that dark place, for example? What do we need to understand for us to be able to relate and comprehend and show that caring and compassion and ask those questions for someone who is going through a really horrible time mentally? Where do we start that conversation with ourselves? Because I know there's a disparity out there with the opinions about suicide in general. How do we get people to a place of looking at it by the lens of compassion rather than the lens of, let's say, confusion?
And again, I go back to one of the most helpful things that is happening over the years is these conversations, just in general, in communities, in organisations, to help people. You know, you might be a person who has struggled with thoughts of suicide in the past, and being able to have a conversation with someone can make all the difference in the world, because traditionally the stigma might have stopped people from letting others know or from people reaching out to help.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good way. I think, like any stigma, the more that we talk about it, the more that we provide that platform for voices to be shared and stories to be shared, hopefully the stigma will start to be less and less and less as we go on. Let's go over to your work in the police force in Frontline, because obviously we are at the Frontline Mental Health Conference, and this is what we're all here to do, is to share stories. So tell us about your time in the force.
What year? It was a longer time ago. It was around 1996, I would say, that I went down to the police academy, followed in the footsteps of my brother, who was already a serving member. So, yeah, that was 1996.
Wow.
Seems like a lifetime ago.
How long did you serve in the police force?
Look, in terms of, I mean, people here at this conference, it's like a blink.
Yeah.
It was 6 years. But after I left the police, then I still continued to work with police on a joint investigation team.
Okay.
So a sworn officer for 6 years, and then working with police on other matters.
Wow. So let's go back to, I guess, talking about the frontline mental health and the mental health of frontline workers. What's your general overview in terms of the state that we're looking at and what we need to deal with for the mental well-being of our frontline workers?
And this is something I've seen in my own family. When you're in positions where you're faced with situations and incidents that can, and they do impact, we're human, we're just people after all, that we really need to understand that it can impact people differently.
Mm.
But for many people, frontline workers, there might come a time where that's building up and building up.
Mm-hmm.
So what's important to know is that the earlier help and support can be engaged in a way that feels comfortable for that person, then the less likely people will have longer term, I guess, mental health issues or problems or you know, the help that's there earlier is always going to be the best approach, prevention.
Yes.
Rather than a reaction mm-hmm. of now somebody's really, really struggling and that we put them through this process. We've got to think about well-being right from the very first day that you come out of that academy at graduation. Mm-hmm. It should be built in as part of everyday policing or within the firefighter community, our paramedics. It should be something that is actually part of the skills that people learn.
Absolutely.
To help each other and themselves.
So your, I guess, training and facilitation of the Living Works Assist program?
Yes.
Is that what it's called?
And the others, yeah, yep. Assist. Yes.
How many programs are there with Living Works?
There's quite a few. We have an online program. We mm-hmm. have shorter half-day programs. Mm-hmm.
So do you roll this coursework out with the police force now?
We absolutely do. Fantastic. And we have been doing for some time, not only here in Australia, but around the world.
Great. I think I read in your bio that Living Works has reached, I think, 2.5 million people. Wow. That's incredible.
It'd be probably a lot more by this point.
Awesome. And have you seen the benefits of the coursework being rolled out amongst your previous peers and colleagues within the police force in particular? Great.
I have. And I hear regularly back from people who will get back in touch and say, I'm so appreciative of the training that I did and let me know that they'd actually used it within 3 to 4 weeks to have that conversation with someone they were worried about. So I know the value of it and I know that it helps people feel comfortable.
Absolutely.
And have the skills to be able to do that.
You touched on the well-being aspect a moment ago. In a perfect world for a frontline worker, whether you're in the police force, whether you're in the ambulance, a fire brigade, et cetera, what does that overall well-being picture look like? Obviously, you need to look after your mental well-being, your emotional health, your physical health. Is there a template that you can use in the force? I'm sure there isn't, but in a perfect scenario, what would a holistic well-being program look like for someone in the force?
Look, I think it covers all of those things that you're talking about, but I also think that it needs to be flexible and tailored to suit individual needs, because what suits one person might be very, very different to what another person needs. So it's great, I guess, to have different options. There's no one solution, there's no one support that can cover everything. So having the flexibility to be able to link in and engage with a variety of different services or helps or support, the better that would be for first responders to be able to reach out in the way that they want to be able to reach out.
What about your family? You come from a line of frontline workers, your dad being a firey and your brother also being in the police force. What did you notice about their well-being after, I'm assuming your dad was a firey for quite some time?
32 years.
32 years, wow. And what about your brother in the police force?
Yeah, I think he did about 15 years in the police
force.
Wow,
okay, so a long time. Yeah. What did you notice about their well-being from, I guess, the moment they started till they retired? Did you see much difference?
I did. As the daughter of a firefighter, I guess the things that I were noticing at different times in his career were times when he would sort of withdraw a bit from the family. Mm. He would be very quiet. My dad wasn't a person that would speak, you know, much about the work that he did, but there was always a sense of knowing when he was struggling with something that he might have, you know, experience during his work in the fire brigade. Sometimes that might come out as, you know, withdrawing from the family. Sometimes he might use anger as a way to express it. Sometimes he, you know, would drink. He came from a generation where it was like, you know, suck it up sort of thing, man up.
Yep.
So for him, he was very protective of showing emotions about any of the work that he had done. But sometimes the build-up is so great that it does come out.
Absolutely. It's bound to, really, isn't it? Yeah.
Recently I was looking through some of my dad's things that I still have from his time in the fire brigade, and I came across a clipping. And that clipping was from when he retired. So when he retired, the local newspaper had done a bit of a story on him. And I've read that article many times. Now, this is going back in 1996, so about the same time that I'm
Entering the force.
And then my dad was retiring. what I noticed when I read that article recently, which I didn't notice way back then, was he was asked a general question, something like, how many fires have you fought in your career?
Mm-hmm.
And he started to answer that and he said, oh, too many to remember. And straight away he started to talk about the Lerner Park fires.
Right.
That interview, and he talked about how hard it was. It's still with him. It's still something that, you know, even many years later. When I read that recently, it occurred to me he did that interview in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
The Lerner Park fires were in 1979.
Wow.
So almost 20 years later,
yes.
When asked, that's the thing that first comes to mind.
So he was on site at Lerner Park.
Yeah, absolutely.
I remember watching this documentary on ABC probably a couple of years ago now about that exact incident. It was horrendous, obviously, but gosh, for your dad to be carrying that around for 20-something years, that's a lot, isn't it?
Lots. We've come a long way from then in understanding the impact, you know, that first responders feel and are exposed to and the trauma that can build up.
Yeah. And I guess a final question for you, what do you feel needs to shift or change for frontline workers and their mental health to continue to be under the spotlight in a healthy way and to be improved? Because I get the sense that there's a lot of improvement that needs to be done in this area. What does that look like for you?
I guess what it looks like for me is acknowledging the motivation and the willingness now within emergency services to really start to focus on the well-being of all the people who serve. I think we need to continue that, and I think the support needs to come, you know, at all levels, all ranks, all duties, that this is community problem, a community of first responders. So as a community, the way to address that is together.
Yeah.
And it won't be one, you know, one pot solution, that we need to think broader than that. What can we all do? What part can we all play in looking out for each other and making sure the sorts of supports are there for those when they need them in the way that they need them?
That's a really great answer. You've been a delight to speak to, Belinda. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Beautiful.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this episode. Feel free to share with your friends and colleagues. And if you know someone working in mental health that you'd like to see featured on the podcast, please email any suggestions to us at membership@anzmh.asn.au. You can also stay up to date on our socials at ANZMHA on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Thank you so much for listening, and we look forward to sharing our next episode with you next week.